and welcome to this month's episode of the Zeitgeist Tapes. My name's Emma Burnell, I'm a political journalist. I'm joined, as always, by Professor of Political History, Steve Fielding. Hi, Steve.
Hello, Emma. Hello, listener.
And we're delighted to be joined by a semi-regular friend of the pod, our friend who is a journalist and writer on culture, Tim Worthington. Hello, Tim.
Hello, or I should really say in the context of what we're talking about, be seeing you.
Be seeing you, absolutely, yes. So as Tim has alluded to there, we are covering this week The Prisoner, the 1960s half-adventure serial, half-weird psychedelic mashup. I have to admit that before rewatching it or starting to rewatch it for this podcast, I hadn't really seen most of it since I was a little girl. And what I remembered mostly was the killer bubbles, which is quite an extraordinary bit of imagery. But I think, Tim, given you're probably our super fan, do you want to tell us a little bit about what The Prisoner is all about?
Yeah, The Prisoner is basically, well, it's something that people have tried to describe and define, and it's not really possible, which might be why, kind of, when The Guardian do their articles about where the high concept TV started, they start in the late 90s with Buffy, they never mention The Prisoner, but it's essentially, for reasons we don't know, and we never find out, a high-ranking, appears to be intelligence officer in the opening titles, which I will come back to in a bit, walks into a very imposing looking office, slams down a letter of resignation, and then he wakes up after somebody pours gas through his keyhole in a weird Italian village, which actually turned out to be Port Merion in Wales, and they tried to hide that on the original transmission, where basically he's allowed to do everything except leave.
So he is the prisoner. He is rechristened as a number. He is number six. And his endless tussles are with number two, who is sort of in charge of the village, but not in charge of the project. Number two answers, obviously, to number one.
But we never see number one, do we? Number one is the ultimate power, the authority, but we don't know who or what number one is, do we?
We never really find out who number one is. And number two, of course, changes on a regular basis. Now, the episode that we're going to talk about today, in particular, is an episode with an election in it, obviously, for our purposes. That works pretty well. And it's the election to be number two. And they convince, number six to stand to be number two, which is a complicated thought. And he initially reluctant, he gets quite involved in the campaign and tries to run a campaign based on freedom. And if you elect me, we can all live and be free. Shall we have a listen now to some of his campaign rhetoric?
Yeah. There are those who come in here and deny that we can supply every conceivable civilized amenity within our boundaries. You can enjoy yourselves, and you will. You can partake of the most hazardous sports, and you will. The price is cheap.
All you have to do in exchange is give us information. You are then eligible for promotion to other and perhaps more attractive spheres. Where do you desire to go?
What has been your dream? I can supply it. Winter, spring, summer or fall, they can all be yours at any time. Apply to me, and it will be easier and better.
There are those who come here with a fresh faith, with an enthusiasm that cannot be denied. Beware. Be careful. Their promises ring richly in your ears. Our friend number six has a splendid record. He has adapted himself admirably to our procedure, but he has no experience whatsoever of the manipulation of such a community as ours. Beware! Has he got the administrative ability to implement his policies? Can you trust him?
Place your trust in the old regime. The policies are defined, the future certain. The old regime, forever. And the old number two, forever. Confession by coercion, is that what you want? Vote for him! And you have it! Or stand firm upon this electoral platform and speak a word without fear. The word is freedom. They say six of one and half a dozen of the other. Not here. It's six for two and two for nothing and six for three for all, for three for all. Vote. Vote.
Right. So that illustrates in the episode, it's a kind of, this particular episode is a kind of parody of elections, really. And in tune with the rest of the whole basis of the series, it's kind of exposing how we're all controlled. We are all prisoners. You know, Patrick McGoohan, the star of the show, who wrote that episode, he wrote many other episodes, he directed it, he did the theme tune. No, he didn't actually do the theme tune. He did virtually everything else. It was his vision. And I saw some documentary completely by accident on Amazon Prime about the prisoner, and he had a few interviews because he didn't like to talk about it, but he had a very great sensitivity to being told what to do, that he believed we all were individuals but we're all controlled in different ways. So in this episode, it illustrates how we're really controlled in elections. Elections are empty. Because he runs against number two, doesn't he? Number six runs against number two. And for some reason or another, which I'm not entirely clear about, they allow him, number six, to win. And then it's exposed why he did run. And it was so he could be in charge of the village and then let everybody out. Because everybody else are kind of prisoners as well. And they don't seem to want to go. And by the time he kind of gets hands on the levers of power, or the buttons of power, he's then taken by these big heavies, and and it just transpires, it's just another attempt by number two, or one of the number twos, to try to get him to tell them the information that they want him to dispense with, to tell them why he actually resigned, because they're not quite sure why. So it's a kind of a parody of elections, really.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, what I found really interesting, and I think that's, you know, as you go through the series, there's a fascinating sort of difference between the narrative voice and the voices that you're hearing. So they keep saying what they want is information. What drives them is information. Mm. But what actually drives them is conformity. And what Patrick McGoohan has done at the very beginning is break out of his conformist role as part of the machinery of state. And that's what they can't, you know, and whether they are one state or another doesn't seem to really matter. And you're never really sure whether it's his own side going after him or whether it's, you know, the other side. And it becomes clearer that that doesn't matter, because what it is what his big mistake is not in resigning and not telling them properly why, but in not conforming to the system.
Yeah, because he's an individual. He's the only individual in the whole village. Although sometimes one or two pop up, but they always in the end conform. So yeah, it's about the individual. It's about freedom. It's about conformity, and it's also about a secret agent, and that kind of stuff. So it is kind of an adventure mashup. And I actually watched, because Patrick McGoohan, who is now an actor that I guess our listener may not be familiar with, but in the 1960s, he was the bee's knees. He was the cat's whiskers. He was asked to play James Bond, not once, but twice. And he turned it down because he thought it was too violent and too, you know, sexist or disrespectful or immoral. So on TV, he played somebody called John Drake in a series called Danger Man. And it was which was very successful, and it was a very conventional sort of secret agent kind of series. And he got fed up doing it, and he went to Lou Grade, who was controlling the production company at that point, and said, I don't want to do it anymore, but I want to do this. And because it was quite popular, and Lou Grade liked the idea, he commissioned The Prisoner. I mean, literally over a very brief discussion, which is not what you can do in TV these days. You have to go through committees and, you know, editors and all kinds of stuff. So it's, I mean, what I think the series is a bit at times I'm thinking, what the hell's going on here? You know, it's a bit self-indulgent at times. But it was Patrick McGowan's slightly paranoid view of the world and using it, you know, through a kind of an action adventure spy drama kind of a thing. And it does have lots of ideas. Many of them, you know, you're not quite sure where they're coming from. And I think it's really good. And sometimes it's very funny, but sometimes it's very odd and you're kind of scratching your head.
Would today, I mean, it's a very 60s show. And in the 60s, that kind of individual nonconformist was quite a sort of idea of the left, I would say. But would today, would Patrick McGowan be a dreadful bloody libertarian? What do you reckon, Tim?
I don't know, because I think I get a bit annoyed with people routinely point at the prisoner and say it's a libertarian show these days. I think there's a reason why. You see, you don't see those clowns running around in black jackets with white edging on. You see them in the Viva Vendetta masks because it isn't propagating a political idea. It is very apolitical in a lot of ways. It's about, yes, it is about individualism, but it's about rejecting just control, full stop. There isn't a, you know, because he frequently uses the phrase, I think he's used in this one, I'd like to mind my own business. And it's more about, you know, the angle of creeping surveillance. So when you think that was 1966 he started writing it, and I would point to the fact that, I mean, this is very, very me, the opening titles, I went almost overnight from, because I first saw The Prisoner when Channel 4 rerun it when they first started, so it must have been maybe 8 or 9. I begged to stay up to watch it one week because I've read about it in the TV Times. I think the first episode was Many Happy Returns, where he wakes up and finds the village deserted. But when I was a very young child, I was terrified of the opening title to Candlewick Green with the clown turning the handle round. I just about got over that when I saw this thing where a man leaves a job and before he's left the building, you don't even see the hands of the people doing it. People are shredding files, redacting files, putting a photo of him with a robot arm into a drawer saying resigned. That still terrifies me to this day. You know, that absolutely chills my blood. And it's not supposed to, because it's the start of an action series, but it taps into some very primal fears, which I don't think are party political. They're personal political. I mean, one thing I always remember is there was a, this was about 20 years ago, there was some kind of debate on the BBC about the world's greatest novel or something along those lines. Joe Brand, for some reason, was representing 1984. And whoever was presenting said something along the lines of, wasn't it all a bit alarmist? And she said, well, you say that, but when I was a psychiatric nurse, I found a file one day by accident that said I wasn't to be considered for promotion because I dressed, quote, a little too Oxfam. And that sort of thing is real. And The Prisoner kind of, I mean, it was very unnerving watching this the day after we watched Captain America, The Winter Soldier for another podcast, which is basically those ideas now where a terrorist organization are using social media to work out who they got to assassinate in one fell swoop to get, you know, millions of people across the world. And in 66, McGowan was worried about what was on pieces of paper about us all. And yeah, it's got a lot worse since then.
Yeah. I mean, the surveillance theme is kind of there. I mean, it's just there right in your face, isn't it? I mean, but he can't, first of all, there's a TV which is turns on and off whenever they want. They can see into his home whenever they want.
He can't switch off the radio, can he?
He can't switch off the radio. And in various episodes, they always trying to probe into his brain. And there's a kind of experimental stuff going on because all the others being prisoners with information that they want and they want to break them down. But for some reason, he's got information which they really think they really need. So they have to treat him specially. They can't
mess. He's particularly a high asset.
Yeah.
If I recall correctly, they aren't all prisoners, but you don't know which are prisoners and which aren't. So some are watchers and some are prisoners. But there's no clarity over which is which.
Yes, which is also kind of interesting. Yeah. But the ones that are prisoners, they have no compunction to kind of mess with their brains and to kind of maybe turn them into cabbages. And oftentimes, Patrick McGowan's character says, everyone's a cabbage, you know.
Yeah.
So it's a bit, you know, it's all very, you know,
and it's all very centered on him, isn't it? You know, the whole village, oftentimes the activities of the village are largely there as part of an experiment on him.
Yes, because he won't be broken down, because every week number two, and it's always a different number two, he's got a task to break him down to get that information, and he won't conform, and we always rejects, you know, he kind of finds a way of around whatever scheme they've got, bizarre scheme they might have, and then the number two has to leave, and there's another number two. I feel very sorry for the number twos, because
also, there's a quote you can take out of context.
I think I tweeted that and somebody did take it out of context. Yeah. But the number, because the number twos are answerable to this number one, this unseen number one, all powerful number one. And occasionally it's, you know, the number two says that their position is a bit like the prisoners too, except they've accepted the situation, they've conformed, and now they are part of the system which is oppressing him. So basically everybody in the village is a prisoner of some sort, even the guards, is what I would suggest, is what he's suggesting. And the only thing about number six is he hasn't conformed. He's the individual. He's the only individual that's battling against the system.
I mean, what's interesting is that he is, but there are some rules. He sort of battles against the system, but plays by some of the rules whilst doing so. So it's quite interesting. You know, he's very polite all of the time. Yeah, he's never told anyone to fuck off or anything like that.
Well, 1967, 68 ITV, you're not going to be able to say that. But he is personally very respectful. It's just he wants to be left alone, isn't it? He himself is not abusive.
What I do like about this show is, I like lots of things about this show. It's very enjoyable. It's sometimes a little slow in that way that 1960s TV is sometimes a little slow. I mean, I was watching an episode the other day and I don't think anyone spoke for the first 10 minutes. And I was just like, just say things. there is this kind of, half of it is the amazing psychedelic deranged mind of Patrick McGoohan, who's gone free from the shackles of the oppressive danger man. But he always makes sure there's a little action sequence in it that he can look rugged in about three quarters of the way through. So he's not completely free from those shackles.
Yeah, there's always a fight, but there always was a fight in those kinds of series. And What I find about those series, and I think The Prisoner is as guilty of it as the rest of them, is the doubles. I mean, the fight doubles are so rubbish. You can always, maybe it's because in the 1960s TVs were that much smaller and the definition.
Watching it on my 52-inch is not as fair.
Yeah, they say, no, that's not Patrick Boone. It's just some bloke with a wig on that makes him look like him, and he's falling over. That's a really sad thing to point out, because they couldn't help it.
Well, that's quite an important thing, I think, is that while some very strange ideas got into it and got further than maybe people would have allowed had he not been a huge star, that it was, despite the way things have been done now, it was just another TV programme. I mean, if you look at even what ATV, who made it, were making at the time, you know, there were things like The Champions, which is a very weird series about some secret agents that are given powers by a mystical ancient tribe. The same night as The Prisoner started, Jerry and Sylvia Anderson started Captain Scarlet and the Mysterons, which goes really fucking weird. It's nothing like Thunderbirds. It's a terrifying Cold War thing where people blow up in it. Randall Hopkirk deceased. You know, one of the main characters is dead in that, but... No, it's had weirdness running through it like a stick of rock, whereas I think everything else, you know, if you look at something like Department S, it's they've got a weird crime, and they're normal people, but it's got Jason King in it, but, you know, they're normal people solving a weird crime.
One of the number twos was played by the same actor.
Yes, Peter Wingard, yes. They're really good number twos, as it were. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, a lot of them were people that were outcasts in some ways, because, you know, he was... you know, he wasn't out gay, and that ruined his career when that did come out. Mary Morris, brilliant as number two in another episode, was, I don't think it would surprise anyone to find out she was gay as well, but, you know, you didn't admit it in public in those days. There was, I can't remember which one of them had been an actual prisoner of war, and I think was still psychologically damaged by it. I can't remember who that was. You know, a number of them had kind of troubled backgrounds. And also Angelo Muscat, who's the butler. You know, obviously, you didn't really see disabled people on TV in those days, but Patrick McGowan cast him personally. So,
There is an extraordinary lineup of guest stars, isn't there? I mean, kind of a who's who, really. I'm just thinking of some of the ones off the top of my head. You've got Fenella Fielding as the voice in some of the early episodes, the announcer of the village. Yeah. I saw Peter Bowles the other day.
Liam McKeown.
Jim Hacker. Who do I mean?
Paul Eddington.
Come from a past episode. Paul Eddington, that's it. It clearly was, the production values are very high.
Yeah.
No. This is not something that was just tossed out easily. Some of the design is wonderful. I always say that nothing dates something so fast as its vision of the future. And the futuristic sort of style of the village and all the tech just looks so very of the 60s. It's so dated whilst also trying to be futuristic. I absolutely love it.
Yeah, they didn't go for silver wigs, did they? They went for boaters and sailor hats. Because it's basically a prisoner of war camp, isn't it? But it's turned into a holiday camp. It's a holiday camp come prison. But one of the reasons why I think, Emma, you suggested we should watch it was specifically because we are undergoing, hopefully not for much longer, but, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Who knows?
The COVID-19 thing, and in the sense that we're all prisoners in our own homes. Except watching it in that context, I was thinking, mate, you're not a prisoner. I mean,
you know nothing, number six.
You know nothing. We've got it for us.
In many ways, the message of the prisoner is the opposite of what we actually need at the moment, because we do need to conform and stay in our homes and follow the rules.
This is true. Yeah. What would the prisoner do? What would the prisoner do in that context? He'd be out trying to get pissed in a pub, wouldn't he? I mean, he'd be writing for the spectators. But the other thing though, therefore I thought, well, it's ironic he's called the prisoner, but he's actually more free than we are just at the moment. But the other bit was, of course, all the surveillance, that he is being surveilled. And of course, we are now living at a time, I mean, not in Britain so much, but maybe in Britain, you know, that might happen. But in other countries dealing with the crisis, you know, everyone's phones are being used, all kinds of surveillance techniques are being employed now, and they may remain in place after.
And it may be the case that we end up choosing a higher level of surveillance. So, for example, regular testing that we have to undergo in order to have our freedom, and that surveillance versus freedom. Whereas, I don't think Patrick McGowan would not have understood being surveilled as ever being free. It may be the bargain that we have to choose to make at this time.
Yeah. I mean, it would be ironic. Well, I don't know if it'd be ironic, but I wouldn't like the idea that the prisoner could be used by the likes of Toby Young and all of his, and Brendan O'Neill, to say, you know, we have to be aware. We do have to be aware of our freedoms and how we're surveilled. But I wouldn't like that the prisoner could be used to be a basis for an argument that says we have to end the lockdown and gain the freedom of our pubs again. Patrick McGowan, I mean, I saw an excerpt on Canadian TV, and he was complaining that in order to get into the studio, he had to sign himself in. I mean, he really was somebody that didn't like people to know what he was doing. So he himself might have ended up on the Toby Young scale of sort of end of things. I don't know.
Well, I should say, first of all, that would require Toby Young to understand the first thing about television drama and entertainment in any form. So there's not much danger of that happening. But one thing that's interesting about that is whether it has a political alignment. Is there is actually a line in this episode, "Everyone votes for a dictator," which I...
Yeah.
You might have spotted this randomly sometimes in response to either something in the news or just feeling annoyed because the cat's annoyed me or whatever. I will post a screen grab of that on Twitter. It's interesting to see people from all sides and all political persuasions get angry at that because they think that I'm picking on their guy. I'm not. I'm just shouting at the clouds. But, you know, it's anti-Johnson. It's anti-Corbyn. It's anti-Trump. It's anti... You name it. There's somebody waiting in the wings to pipe up and say that I'm calling their guy a dictator. I think that is very telling.
Mm.
I mean, you do take a rather Dada-esque approach to political discourse, Tim, to be fair.
But just so, the idea
it's
that...
It's not always easy to tell what your ultimate aim is.
No, but I mean, my point is that, you know, everyone is reading into that quote from The Prisoner, an image of Patrick McGowan, defining it against themselves, which, again, underlines to me it's very apolitical because... There isn't something you can latch onto and say, you know, that is on my side or that is not on my side. It's libertarianism side. It's just on its own side.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's probably a lot to do with Patrick McGowan's acute kind of awareness of being told what to do. His background is really, really interesting. This sounds like I got it from Wikipedia, but that's probably because I did. That, born in New York of Irish parents who come to Britain. They live in Sheffield, you know, and he's kind of all over the place. So he's from a relatively working class background, which, you know, and then goes into acting. And I think, you know, he's clearly a very tense person because I was watching his hands in The Prisoner and I thought, oh, that's good acting because he's pacing around a lot as a prisoner. Because he's caged and he doesn't settle down. But if you look at his hands are always, he's always kind of bringing, you know, gripping his hands and flexing them. And I thought that's clever because it's showing that he is tense. You know, he is feeling all this surveillance, but he's giving this aura of being quite in control, being quite cool. You know, being the hero. But then I started watching Danger Man, a few episodes of Danger Man, and he does that as well. He still does that. So he's a very tense person and a quite difficult person to interview. Although in the end, one of his best mates was Peter Falk, and he ended up being in Columbo quite a lot of times and directing it. So I'm not sure how you reconcile all that.
Just one more thing.
So we could do Columbo and more of Patrick McGowan. But I think the series, given he came up with the idea, he was executive producer, he wrote quite a lot of the episodes under a different name and all that kind of stuff, like I said, it's his vision. It's his very unique vision. And that was not reducible to left or right or whatever. It was him. So I think what you're saying, Tim, is unsurprising, given that's where he's coming from. That's where the series is coming from. It's coming from him, which maybe makes it all the more fascinating because you can't reduce it to an ideal.
Very idiosyncratic, isn't it?
Yeah, which makes it, that's the thing, that's what makes it kind of fascinating, but also sometimes frustrating.
And it only ran for one series, is that right, Tim?
Yes, but the only real reason, I mean, there are all kinds of lurid stories about, you know, Patrick McGowan, people have claimed he was hospitalised with stress while making it, so things like that. The main reason was money, was Lou Graves was having trouble hawking it to America because it got a bit too strange, and that's that. And that is backed up by what he did with some other programmes. Like, there's a very, in a way, similar Jerry and Sylvia Anderson series called The Secret Service, which would take too long to explain. Basically, it's Stanley Unwin as a priest who has a miniaturising device. And he cancelled that second he saw an episode of it and said, I won't be able to sell that in America. Do something else. And so Lou Grade particularly was that ruthless with things. I mean, there's another very odd series, A Strange World of Gurney Slade, which is from the early 60s, an Anthony Newley thing, not political at all, but it's quite similar to The Prisoner in that he knows he's in the TV series and he can't leave it. And that was cancelled pretty quickly. So it all came down to money in the end. And this was a very expensive show because it was all made on location with, as you mentioned, bespoke, not just bespoke costumes, bespoke buggies and, you know, tannoys and things. Everything in that is stylized, and it was just the cost. It was just too much. So, yeah, in answer to your question, yes, there was only one half series.
And so the final episode. I haven't got to in my rewatch, but I have seen once in my life. I told the lads this before we started. I watched it once in my life with a stonking hangover. It was the day after one of those parties where you wake up and you find half your friends littered on your floor. And we all then sat around in the living room drinking tea and watching The Prisoner.
Well, I watched it stone cold sober relatively recently for this. And I hadn't got a flipping clue what was going on.
Thank God. So it wasn't just me.
And it went over two episodes as well. It was a two-part final episode, which extended it. I mean, at one moment, number one is exposed and it's Patrick McGowan's face. So was he saying he was number one all the time? But it wasn't kind of saying that. And then it kind of ends with them going back to Westminster, and because he kind of, that's where he lived originally, where he was gassed and brought up, and then he goes back to the house, but it seems like he's going to start again as well, so he hasn't really escaped, he's just going to become a prisoner again at the end. That's about as much sense as I could make of it, but it's, I mean, it, to describe what actually happened, I just,
the monkey at one point, remember that,
it's completely bizarre. I don't know if Tim made more of it, if he saw it relatively recently.
Tim, it is your role in life to translate confusing telly to the rest of us. So tell us, what the hell does it all mean?
Yes.
Well, I mean, there are, you know, themes are explored in it that aren't really part of a coherent narrative. But I have come to the conclusion over the years that it was a deliberate attempt to confuse people, because I think what is most fascinating about The Prisoner is it's like a logic bomb. It's got its own internal, everything makes sense within the programme, within Patrick McGowan's mind. But you think you figured out one thing and then another bit springs out of it. It's like that thing the Beatles were obsessed with around the same time, the Nothing Box, which is like a box of lights where random lights kept flashing. And John Lennon was obsessed with working out a formula to work out which one would flash next. It's kind of like that. You just can't pin it down. And I think McGowan hadn't anticipated, because there were one or two things he did explain, like the penny farthing. There's a lot of stuff in it, like the phones not having a seven on them, and the cat that's sometimes in it, and the broken plates that were never explained. That I think he got so fed up with people asking, because people stopping him in the street, like, you know, literally stopping him physically and say, you've got to tell me what this is about. And I think he just ramped it up deliberately in the finale to annoy everyone, which is, in a way, it's a bit more honest than the makers of Lost saying, we'll give you all the answers, and then not giving you any. You know, just saying it all happened just because. But,
and in many ways, it doesn't it match the ethos of the series not to give us a straight set of answers? We don't get information. We don't get conformity.
Yeah, clever. Oh, that's it. That you've solved it. To my satisfaction, anyway, you've solved it.
Well,
there you go. I am the genius who finally unlocked.
Well, in a weird way, that's reflected in, I just mentioned I wasn't going to bring this up, but the explanation for the penny farthing that he gave at the time was, it's the idea of ironic progress, that people keep improving and redeveloping, reinventing the bicycle, and it is still the same machine. Right. And really, you know, the concerns that were raised in The Prisoner were, you know, they've got more sophisticated over the years. We buy into them now by signing up to apps and so on, but it's still the same mechanisms. I hadn't thought of that until just now. So I'll let you both take credit for that amazing insight.
So if our listener hasn't actually ever seen The Prisoner, and I'd be surprised if they haven't seen at least one episode in the dim and distant past, but I think it's definitely worth a revisit, particularly in these times. And yes, they might.
Hey, what else are you going to do with your time, man?
Just go slowly mad and eat crisps and drink too much, really. Isn't that what everyone else is doing?
It sounds like my weekend.
A never-ending weekend. That's what we're doing.
No, I genuinely have really enjoyed revisiting The Prisoner. I haven't finished my rewatch yet, but I will. And it's not always when we do something that I've reached the episode that we're going to largely focus on that I carry on with these shows if I haven't been particularly enjoying it. I haven't watched a single edition of The Crown after we finished our coverage of it.
No, you wouldn't need to. No, it was all but
I'm going to keep going with The Prisoner.
Right.
Baffling though it is, it's enjoyably baffling. So thank you very much, Tim, for joining us. Thanks, Steve, as always.
My pleasure, as always.
And just to say thank you to Lord Wood of Anfield for our theme tune. Please do, if you've enjoyed this, rate and review it on iTunes. It does help people to find the podcast. And this has been a Political Human production. Thank you very much.
Goodbye.